Well, it is being used in several college classes. The courses I've seen it used in is in environmental sociology. Why do you think this book is useful in that kind of class?
You know, I think just given the feedback that I've gotten from several professors in various parts of the country, one of the things that the book does that very, very few other works do is to really bring together these two hot button and important issues in an interesting way, and that is immigration and environmental conflict, environmental politics. And so, you know, many books do a great job of dealing with one or the other, but it's, I think, fairly rare when a book actually brings these two together and does so around what I think is a particularly interesting case study that was really just presented to us when we heard about what was happening in Aspen. So I think the second thing that people who are also interested in the intersection of social inequality and environmental politics, or environmental justice, that issue, the book's focus on this concept of environmental privilege, I think, is something that a number of people have said is an interesting and useful teaching tool.
Why did you choose Aspen? What piqued your interest? You and co-author Lisa Sun-Hee Park, what attracted the both of you to this area?
Well, you know, we were living in Colorado at the time and really loved the state, loved the Rocky Mountains. And we had visited and traveled to Aspen a number of times. And like most people we know who'd been there, fell in love with the place. And but this was a different story, one we hadn't heard before and one that, you know, wasn't readily evident to us. It wasn't readily apparent to us that there were these underlying questions and tensions around meeting the needs of a community, both in terms of labor and in terms of environmental sustainability and various cultural issues, and how all of this kind of came together in that resolution the Aspen City Council sort of approved in 1999. So we came to this and we were interested in you know, these two issues, immigration politics and environmental politics. Lisa Park's primary focus in her teaching and research is on immigration, and my primary focus is on environment. So we just thought that this was a natural fit for us to sort of bring our two talents or two interests together and to see what we could come up with.
And you studied kind of two different things, environmental privilege and environmental injustice. Can you explain what both of those mean?
Sure. So we begin with the idea of environmental injustice, variously referred to as environmental injustice or environmental inequality or environmental inequity, and in a particular case, in environmental racism, if it involves minorities or people of color. And the idea there is that, you know, generally speaking, in the United States and frankly around the globe, where we observe social inequality across the landscape, we are also very likely to find situations of environmental inequality. That is, situations where people who are less privileged economically, who have less access to the political system, people who are culturally marginalized in a given society, are simply much more likely to live and work and environments and spaces and physical spaces that are compromised ecologically, that are more likely to be ecologically hazardous and dangerous, more likely to live in a community with a toxic waste dump or live in close proximity to a landfill or other locally unwanted land uses. And this is something that is a pattern that we observe throughout the United States, and as I said, in many other parts of the globe. So that's environmental injustice, environmental inequality. And as I said, if we're talking about minorities or people of color, when they're facing this situation, we tend to call that environmental racism. Well, we thought it was curious, though, that the overwhelming majority of research and media coverage of this issue and policy work legislative work on this issue focuses on the people who are essentially the victims or the survivors, the unfortunate folks, those populations who are dealing with the short end of the stick, who are living and working in more highly polluted and compromised environments. And so we thought, yeah, but what about the other end of the equation? What about those spaces, those places where people are living relatively privileged lifestyles and whose experience with the environment, with nature, with air, land, water, etc., is one not of exposure to toxics and pollutants, but of one that is an experience of not necessarily living and working in pristine environments, but relatively protected and much more clean, much cleaner environments. And so we thought, yeah, let's think about kind of the flip side of environmental justice or environmental injustice. And that brought us to this concept of environmental privilege. And we define environmental privilege as that situation where people have exclusive or near exclusive access to coveted ecological amenities, clean air, clean water, unsullied and unpolluted land, waterfront properties, access to forested spaces, to green space, etc., and to elite neighborhoods. And so this is sort of an ecological or an environmental twist on the common wisdom that we have, that we used in common parlance about, you know, living on the other side of the tracks. So although that's a bad part of town, or wow, what a wonderfully nice neighborhood you live in. You live, this is how the other half lives. So it's very much a part of our language, our cultural lexicon, in terms of class, and often in terms of race. But what we wanted to do was push that common lexicon to embrace the environmental dimensions of that as well. Hence, environmental inequality, environmental injustice on one side of the tracks, and perhaps the 1% is where we find environmental privilege. So that was the idea.
Well, sure. And if I could just read a quick passage from the book, Aspen and the Roaring Fork Valley is just one of the planet's many sites built as a refuge from undesirable people and as a place where nature can be manipulated for the convenience and enjoyment of a handful of elites. Aspen is environmental privilege at work.
Exactly. Yes. And, you know, I want to be clear, we are big fans of Aspen. We try to get there as often as possible. And I think it's fair to say we enjoy Aspen as much as anyone else who's allowed to enjoy it. People, you know, of means, who are well-heeled, as we are, as college professors. But yes, from the passage you read, a critical segment of that passage is that Aspen is not unique. It is one of many, many places on the planet that really reflects this environmental privilege. And what we wanted to do was, of course, problematize that and to say that we need to actually link environmental privilege to environmental disadvantage or environmental injustice. And I think it's a mistake or a blind spot in the policy work, in the environmental activism out there, and in the research when we don't make that link. And this is what brought us to this project.
The next, I guess, point is that in 1999, the Aspen City Council sort of pointed to immigration as a cause of environmental problems. Why was immigration pinpointed?
You know, it's a complex history both in Aspen and nationally. This is something that we as a nation have dealt with. And not so well, but it's also something that the environmental movement nationally in this country and in other countries, places like Australia, places like Russia, places like Canada, places like Germany, Sweden, England, and elsewhere. So again, Aspen is an illustrative example of this broader trend. The fact is that before climate change became a real big issue for many people in terms of the public discourse, I think it's fair to say that at least since the early 1970s, the late 1960s, population growth, human population growth, has always been at the top of our minds, specifically those of us who would call ourselves environmentalists, that we've got to get population growth, human population growth, under control, because it's so obviously taxing our ecosystems. It's so obviously placing our biosphere at risk. And so what we do is we take a look at how that logic plays itself out in Aspen. And, you know, there's absolutely no question that population growth, we are now, 6 billion plus people on planet Earth, that is having a serious impact on our ecosystem and on our natural resource base. But the question is when we actually then implement policies, whether it's a 1999 resolution in the city of Aspen or following that in Pitkin County, or whether it's actual population control practices in a place like China or elsewhere, the question is, who are we focusing on? Who gets targeted as the people who are really, frankly, reproducing too much at too high a rate? And our argument in this book is no different than the argument that others have made, and that is that the vulnerable, the poor, and women and immigrants tend to be targeted when these people are precisely the last people on Earth who are able to command the political power to challenge such laws. And frankly, these are the people on a per capita basis who actually produce the lightest ecological footprint. And so we think that, yes, population growth is a concern. It should be a concern. And if we're going to deal with that, then we have to deal with it intelligently and not, frankly, beat up on the least among us in terms of the people with the least amount of economic and political power who are also producing the least amount of ecological impact. And if we're going to really ask the question, where are the greatest ecological impacts, we can't ignore population. Let's actually look at the proper population, the correct populations. And that would actually force us to look at people in wealthier parts of the world and individuals and communities and families who are wealthier than most. And that forces us then to say, well, then let's look at the United States and let's look at the middle and the upper class, and let's look at Aspen. And these are populations, these are places in the world where, by virtue of that wealth that has been accumulated, people have, on a daily basis, a relationship with our ecosystems that is frankly much more impactful than your average immigrant coming over the border from south of the United States. If we could say the same then about many large corporations, public and private. We could say the same about certainly the United States military, which it is often said, and I think truthfully, is the greatest polluter of any institution in this country. And so if those things are true, then how is it then that we end up focusing on, again, the least among us and blaming them? Well, I think the answer is both complex and simple. It's simple in the sense that, well, it's easy to blame those who are least able and capable of fighting back and mounting a challenge. It's much more difficult to try to rein in a system, a market system that creates wealth and that celebrates wealth, and to problematize that. And it's very difficult in this country, particularly at a moment of frankly decline economically and geopolitically, to attack or criticize our military for being a voracious consumer of ecosystems and polluter of ecosystems. So I think it's a complex set of factors that led us to this point where the Aspen City Council, I think, problematically focused on an easy target for blame with respect to our ecological crisis.
And you know, I'm not sure that a lot of people think of the environmental movement pointing to immigration as a cause of the country's ecological crises. Does this still happen today?
Yes, it does. And you know, in the book, we sort of point to a fairly simple, I guess you would say, a logical an equation that I think runs through people's minds. Certainly those people whom we would call nativist environmentalists, people who describe themselves as concerned about ecosystem protection, therefore they're environmentalists, but who also are concerned about immigration control, thus nativists. These people start often with the following observation, that population growth is the greatest threat to our ecosystems. And again, as I said, that's highly debatable and questionable, but that's what they begin with. Population growth is the greatest threat to our ecosystem's sustainability. The next thing they then say is that immigration is the greatest contributor to population growth in the United States. And certainly at the time that we were writing the book, a few years ago, that was true. That may or may not be true today, but I think it still is. And therefore, then we take those two claims and we arrive at a third conclusion, which is then that immigration must be the greatest threat to our ecosystems. And that's where we have problems, because that's not necessarily true. But yes, there are, I would say, most environmentalists, most people who call themselves environmentalists, don't draw that connection, don't draw those conclusions. But most environmentalists I know are deeply worried about population growth. And so I think there's a way in which this logic of nativist environmentalist logic of essentially blaming immigration for our environmental problems is something that many people find logical, find appealing. Of course, most environmentalists describe themselves, I think it's fair to say, as politically progressive, and so many of them would perhaps bristle at this idea of blaming immigrants. But yet the logic, if we begin with this logic of population growth being the greatest problem, we can easily get there. But yes, there are people, there are organizations that see this as the main problem and think that the only way we can focus on this and promote a nativist environmentalist agenda is to get people to move out of their comfort zone of being politically correct and in their view, having the guts to say something that might not be popular, which is that, in their view, again, I think it's erroneous, but that immigration is the leading cause of our environmental decline.
Okay, and in the book, you mention your goal of examining the Roaring Fork Valley over that four-year period was to better understand the growing economic and racial inequalities from the perspective of environmentalists and immigrants. How did you go about doing that? Do you think you accomplished it?
Yes, I mean, I think it's far more complex topic than we could get our heads around in just one book. But we approached it from a number of angles. You know, we looked at it historically, looked through a number of historical documents, looked at a lot of government documents produced in and around Aspen, looked at a lot of books that have been written by historians and other scholars about this issue, and sort of placing present day or contemporary Aspen in a broader historical context, and asking, how did we become so unequal, something that a lot of us are asking about the United States as well, and some really good work on that from a national perspective. And then we also approached it then from a research perspective of actually talking to people and interviewing people and asking them, how do they interpret these changes? How do they think the growing inequality between the haves and have-nots, between citizens and immigrants, between immigrants who have provisional inclusion, green cards, perhaps even citizenship, and those immigrants who are here without authorization, who are undocumented, and looking at inequality along gendered lines as well, and race included. So there are a number of axes along which we explore inequality in the book. But I will say that it again, it's such a complex topic that I think we're only beginning to scratch the surface.
Well, and considering the gap between the haves and the have-nots is growing, and the number of ecological crises is growing around the world, I mean, what does this mean? Will the group that has been targeted as maybe a cause for environmental problems, will that only grow under sort of the scenario we're living in today?
Yeah, I would say the problem of inequality, you put your finger right on it. We have simultaneously, right, growing social inequality nationally, globally, without question, and growing extremely problematic and troubling environmental crises. And I think the mistake is to see these as separate. And so what we try to do, and what the scholarly literature on environmental justice studies tries to do, is to bring those two observations together and to see them not only as connected, but as inseparable. And so, you know, for me as a sociologist, I think the technical issues, the scientific ways of thinking about environmental crises are very, very helpful. But as a sociologist, for me, I think when someone asks me, what do I think the leading cause, the leading driver of our ecological crises might be? And I say it's both simple and complex. It's simple because it is one thing. It is social inequality. But it is complex because it is very difficult to wrap our heads around how to reverse or to lessen and reduce the invidious impacts of social inequality. So I, you know, to repeat, I think social inequality is the most important number one driving force behind our environmental crises. But it also then makes it that much more difficult to address our environmental crises politically for a whole host of reasons. I mean, number one of which is, of course, you have people who are very well off, who have a deep investment in this system, and who have far more say and influence and control over the contemporary and future direction of our social system, of our political system, of our market system than most everyone else. And then on the flip side, those of us who are not terribly well-heeled and well-off may be concerned about the social crisis, the ecological crises, and may see them as linked, but we may be in a much more desperate, tenuous situation in terms of just meeting our daily needs. And so it may be more difficult to challenge or confront that system when we're trying to put food on the table. So I think, again, social inequality for me as a sociologist is the most important issue we should be focusing on in terms of what is driving the environmental crises, but I also think it's going to be the most difficult problem to address.
Okay, and then one last question, David. We kind of talked a little bit about the examples of environmental privilege in Aspen and the Roaring Fork Valley. What kinds of examples did you see of environmental injustice?
Yeah, well, I think in terms of the Roaring Fork Valley, we saw examples where people are living in trailer parks, trailer homes, in flood zones, in environments that are economically vulnerable. We saw with, for example, down the Roaring Fork Valley from Aspen, the Bonanza trailer park home situation many years ago, where people were displaced. They were forced to leave those homes and put up a fight. But in the end, my understanding is that they lost. They were able to exercise some political power and leverage in terms of making that issue visible, making it a public issue, but we're only able to go so far with that. And again, at the same time, I would never want to separate environmental harm from environmental privilege. And so while we find people working and living in compromised and vulnerable environments, people throughout the Roaring Fork Valley, working lower wage jobs, working under conditions of at-will employment, very few, if any, labor unions and the ability to engage in collective bargaining, and living in housing situations where people have very little privacy, very little breathing space because you're living with so many other people who feel excluded and not fully represented in the school system. At the same time, then we find people throughout the Roaring Fork Valley, and particularly in places like Aspen, who are not dealing with those situations, who are dealing with just the opposite. Plenty of living space, plenty and sufficient access to education, to healthy and sustainable and nutritious food, plenty of access to the political system, et cetera, and plenty of access to the ski slopes and the green spaces that the Roaring Fork Valley has to offer folks. So I think, again, I always want to ensure that we think about environmental privilege and environmental inequality or environmental injustice is always linked.
Sure, and I'm sure it's recognizable in several parts of the country, but here the divide is maybe a little bit more obvious.
Yes, I think that's absolutely true.
Okay. Any more research planned in the Roaring Fork Valley?
We would love to come back, and we've gotten a lot of good feedback from folks on all sides of the issue. There, people have been very, very gracious and responsive to what we've said in the book, and plenty of criticism, I would say, most of it totally justified. And we have thought about coming back to the Roaring Fork Valley to do a follow-up on this same issue, and I think we may very well do that in the years ahead, but no concrete plans at this point.
Well, David, thank you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your interest. Thanks for doing this story.